Welcome to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer, producer and host of this program, and it's good to be with you. This week we are bringing you a talk from Creative Morning's monthly breakfast series. We'll hear from Kyle Steery on the topic of spectrum. And this presentation was recorded outdoors, so you will hear some road noise in the background. Please keep that in mind if you are listening while driving. The next voice you'll hear will be Creative Morning's host, Kara Hackett, introducing Steery. Please enjoy the show.
All right. In the moment that we've all been waiting for, I would like to introduce Kyle Steery. Kyle is a board certified behavior analyst and licensed behavior analyst in the state of Michigan. He has over 10 years of experience working with children and adults who exhibit severe problems and behaviors and or deficits in communication skills, social skills, and daily living skills. He is currently a program supervisor providing behavioral supports for children and adults who have developmental disabilities and is a researcher for the Why We Do What We Do podcast. He served as communications chair for the Hoosier Association for Behavioral Analysts for 3 years and has presented research at Michigan Autism Conference on the efficacy of state and ethical intervention strategies. Kyle is passionate about using scientific knowledge base to create fun, safe, effective learning environments and sharing how a scientific mindset can really make the world a better place. Give it up for Kyle Steery.
Woo! Hey! Thank you, thank you. How's everybody doing? This is so cool. There's nothing cooler than Midwest fall evenings, I don't think at least. This is amazing, guys. Thanks so much for having me. Hi to everybody here. Everybody socially distanced and masked. It's very cool. Hi, everybody in social media land. I do a lot of telehealth now. I meet with clients over telehealth, like Zoom calls. And I have really poor internet, so I'm used to like getting stuck in these really unflattering poses when like the internet lags. So I'm going to like try to look as cool as possible this whole time because I don't want to look goofy. This is not even anything to do. I do yoga. I watch somebody who does yoga on YouTube and I try to do what they're doing. And I do it pretty poorly. And I was like stuck in this hole yesterday. And I was like down like this. And like it wasn't stopping. She was just keeping this hole going and going. And I was like, what is going on? This hurts so bad. And my internet was just frozen. And so I thought I was doing this really like good stretch. And I... But it's good to be here. Thanks so much. Thank you, Kara. This is awesome. Thank you, Olivia. Olivia is actually my sister-in-law. She asked me maybe like a year ago if I wanted to do something like this, and then I said, yeah. And then I forgot about it until like a month ago, but I'm still super excited about it. This is great. So like Kara said, the theme is spectrum this month. So I thought about spectrum. Two opposite extremes. And then everything that falls in between those two extremes. When a light beam hits a prism, it's separated into a spectrum of color. You may fall somewhere on like a political spectrum. As a board certified behavior analyst, I've worked primarily with individuals who have a range of developmental disabilities, including autism spectrum disorder, a disability whose signs and symptoms vary so much person to person that the word spectrum is actually in the title of it. Our world is full of just extremely wide range of experience, wide range of situation and context. My situation, my experience and context, I got into behavior science about 10 years ago. Just sheer randomness of the universe, I needed a job and I found a friend who could offer one. I was playing guitar, playing keyboard in some pretty cool bands, but you don't really make any money doing that. You get free drinks at bars, but you don't. Your newborn doesn't really care about the free drinks you're getting. So I needed a job, but I began to learn the behavioral sciences through a bunch of mentors. It's right here in Fort Wayne. And it was really cool. There's too many of them to name, but for some reason they decided to invest in me, invest their time and effort. And I'm really grateful for that they did. So I practiced behavior analysis. So what is behavior analysis? This may be totally new and different than what you ever heard before. By the way, I have to thank you guys for making this for me. This is great. But it's an analysis. Behavior analysis is a science. It's a natural science. At its core, it's really just about how we learn. Specifically, it's about how our environment interacts with promotes, suppresses, ultimately selects the things that we do, our behavior. There's a lot of levels of selection. There's, you know, biological selection, our genetics, natural selection. There's cultural selection. The things we do can be influenced by the world around us, and that influences. And then there's our own individual histories of learning, and that's the main focus of behavior analysis, is looking at what somebody's learned and why they're doing what they're doing. Consequences, specifically, the things that happen after we do stuff, that they kind of determine the probability of how likely we are to do something again later. So behavior analysts, my job is to really analyze the antecedents and the consequences of what's going on and really try to understand why we do what we do, which is a great name of a podcast if you ever want to listen to it. And ultimately, our job is just to make socially important change, understanding that behavior can be pretty straightforward and simple and then get really complex really quickly. Ultimately, though, if I'm not helping people, if we aren't helping people as a profession, then we're not doing applied behavior analysis. We're not doing our job. So we're ultimately trying to help people. So I'll go through some examples of what selection kind of looks like and see if it makes sense. So infants, babies, my four-month-old is hanging out right over there. They kind of begin cooing. They make babbling sounds. They blow raspberries at a couple months old. I have four kids, so I've seen this before. Babies also spit up a lot. They don't tell you about that part for some reason. And I don't know if you need to hear about how hard it is to raise kids, but my wife is awesome, and she's over there too. But anyway, in the variety of sounds that a baby can make, ooh, ah, ga-ga, na-na, those types of things, some of those sounds can make more noticeable impressions on the environment around that child. Specifically, the sound like a ma sound, right? That sound, if the child makes that sound, it's probably going to have some pretty noticeable effects specifically on that kid's mom, right? She might look at the baby, might pick the baby up, get excited, smile, repeat the sound back. Baby likes this. Baby begins making that sound more. Soon that sound gets selected in other ways. Mom holds the baby closer when they make the sound. And if all the sounds that child is capable of making, that ma sound starts to occur more frequently. So it occurs at a higher rate than other sounds. And that's really because those other sounds haven't produced that change on the environment. They didn't bring mom closer like that sound did. And they don't do things that are as cool as mom picking me up and playing with me. As time goes on, that behavior kind of evolves from to ma to mama. I never really got to mother. Some people say mother. But that behavior was selected. It was reinforced, and the consequences that were provided as a result of it selected that. Another example, so like a kid might like act out in class. These are a lot of the kids that I end up working with. And maybe he's doing something like making fart noises with his armpit or something. I don't know if kids still do that or not. He's probably putting it on TikTok or something. Is TikTok still a thing? I don't know. I'm old. But anyway, he does these things. It produces a few effects on the classroom environment. Maybe he's reprimanded by the teacher. Maybe he's sent to the office. Maybe the other kids laugh. As a teacher, they might even think that they're punishing that kid, yelling at him and sending him away. But that behavior keeps happening. So in all actuality, that behavior is not going away. So it's not really being punished. It turns out that those factors that were supposed to be punishing it were actually reinforcing it. He likes that. He likes to get out of class. He likes seeing an authority figure that's really frustrated. Plus, everybody's laughing, so that's great too. So reinforcement doesn't really have to look a certain way. If we keep doing something, it's being reinforced. Our environment's kind of choosing that for us. And so those are kind of like good consequences. Some consequences punish our behavior. They make us stop doing those things. So touching a red stovetop, for example, you do that like one time, you're probably not going to do that ever again. Getting made fun of by kids at another lunch table for trying to sit with them, you might not try to make friends all year. Trying to create a story or a painting, that just never ends up sounding or looking like you quite want it to might just stop you from continuing and doing those things. I'm sure we can all think of examples of times that we did something and met kind of unfavorable consequences, and it makes it less likely, or at least like really hard to try those things again. So I work with children and adults who they engage in pretty severe problem behavior. Things like aggression, self-injury, property destruction. So a little bit of a content warning. Those themes are going to come up. If you've had unfavorable experiences with those themes, just know that I'm going to talk a little bit about them. But problem behavior is sometimes, not always, but sometimes observed in individuals who have developmental disabilities, and that's kind of when I get called in. I'm tasked with designing programs for those people that are designed to help them live in the least restrictive environment possible, and let them have the ability to make the most choices that they can, to allow them to live as freely as possible while keeping themselves safe and other people safe. Historically, even not so long ago, people who exhibit severe problem behavior, they end up in really restrictive settings. And sometimes that's for their safety, but it's often mostly out of either convenience or just because we don't really know what else to do. We're not sure what to do. I happen to think that convenience is a really poor reason to suppress people's freedoms. And so that's why my job's kind of fun. I'll paraphrase Dr. Pat Fryman. We need to be done blaming people. Blaming people doesn't really help. We don't get anywhere when we blame people. We've tried for hundreds of years really to remedy problem behavior with things that are just kind of blanket punishment techniques that don't really do anything. They don't help. If anything, they just help us exercise control. They mostly just make it convenient for us, like I said. So we do things like reprimand people. We take away their freedoms. We over-medicate them, we put them in seclusion, exclusion, restrain them, things that don't really help. They're not therapeutic. They don't teach these people anything. Understanding the environment's role is a kind of a newer thing, but it's a really powerful way of thinking. All right, so for example, and I'll walk you through this. So, not so long ago, a three-year-old kid came to me. He was a child who had autism. He had no spoken words in his repertoire at all. He didn't have any real ways of communicating, no pointing, no pulling on mom, no anything. And he engaged in pretty severe self-injury. He hit his head against walls and things like that. When I first met him, he walked into the room and he had bruises on his forehead. It was really sad. We began to examine things happening in his environment. Like I said, this is what we do. We took data. We saw that over the course of a few days, he was averaging about six times an hour hitting his head against things, which is a lot. We saw zero functional communication. He wasn't really saying, no pointing, anything like that. How frustrating to not be able to communicate the things that you want and need, right? We took notes on the events surrounding those. We found that more often than not, he engaged in this behavior when there was little to no attention being given to him. So I might be talking to somebody else. He might start banging his head, and I'd go over to help, and it would stop. So it kind of clues you in. Like, there might be an attention component to this that it's kind of historically what he's gotten when it's happened. And there's also a component of it through our analysis that we saw he... got offered items. We would bring items to kind of help calm him down. We'd offer some things, and that didn't really work, so we try again, and they find something that he likes, like a toy or something like that, and then headbanging would stop. So there's an access component. Things happen that bring items to me. So that really kind of clued me into, like, we need to teach this kid how to ask for attention and ask for things that he wants. Pretty straightforward. So we intervened with two programs, both of which provided changes to the environment. We did this by introducing prompts. Prompts are just clues of help us know what to do. So like a string around your finger is a prompt, signs are prompts. But we'd open this situation up. A team member would be playing with this kid, and we'd contrive this situation where all of a sudden they weren't giving that kid attention anymore. They'd talk to somebody else. And you'd notice it. He would start to get upset. He'd start to get a little angry. Probably going to engage in that self-injurious behavior, but before he got a chance to, we would provide a prompt. Somebody would guide his hand over to the person's shirt and give it a tug. Again, he didn't have vocal language, so this is the best we could come up with. And a pretty appropriate way for little kids to get attention. So we'd help him pull on somebody's shirt, and they'd right away provide that attention, really, really high-quality attention. And it didn't take long. He figured it out really quick. We didn't even have to provide that prompt anymore. All of a sudden, he was like, hey, this way of getting people's attention is way easier, and it works. He started laughing. He started running around the building, getting everyone's attention by pulling their shirts, which is really funny when people don't expect that or know what's coming. And the rate of problem behavior went down, which is the big thing. The other program was a picture exchange system. This was really similar to it. We provided a prompt where he got to trade pictures of things for the actual things, so it was a way of asking for something. His favorite toy was an electric fan, and actually he really enjoyed watching videos of fans on YouTube. There are channels dedicated to fans. Just, yeah, I don't know if you knew that or not, but they're pretty awesome. But he would exchange this card. We'd provide a prompt where he would pick up the card, give it to somebody, they'd give him his fan, and before long he had 10, 20 items to choose from. He was looking through, what do I want to play with today? It's more fun to play with this person. He chose that more often. And now he was selecting things and getting our attention appropriately. He didn't have to engage in that problem behavior anymore, and it went down to about 0 times an hour, which is really cool. And somewhere in there, he started picking up spoken language. That doesn't always happen, but he started speaking. And last time I saw him, I said bye. And he said, bye bye, Kyle, you poor baby. He always called me poor baby. I don't know why. Something about this said poor baby. So like I said, that's best case scenario. It doesn't always happen like that. It doesn't always happen as easily as that. But it really highlights how a close examination of the environment can really help us make meaningful change. It's a heavy responsibility, I think, to change someone's world like that. But when done correctly, and with that person's best interest in mind, it can be an extremely powerful tool for good. And I really enjoy it. And there's a lot to talk about. I could really fit into this like really short discussion. This way of thinking extends way beyond even developmental disabilities and problem behavior. Behavior analysis has, we're in areas like social skills, teaching vocational skills, helping businesses and organizations not only become better places to work at, but more profitable places as well. Physical fitness, public health, smoking, healthy eating, family training, educational institutions, helping deliver materials in the most effective way. Vehicle and driver safety, these are all areas in which learning is involved. We even have BCBAs in NASA right now helping revamp their training program. It turns out astronauts need to be able to retain information, and they want to know how to do that most effectively. All of this is done, too, without coercion, without threats necessary, no counter controls necessary. Science really is starting to show the results are often unparalleled when an environment is one in which someone likes to learn instead of one which makes someone scared to make a mistake. So what does this have to do with all of us? It's probably all new material. You guys, I hope it was interesting, but you know, what can you take from it? Well, first of all, first and foremost, if you're battling something, if you're battling depression, anxiety, if you're having these thoughts and feelings that are preventing you from making you happy, please call somebody. May this be your prompt to call somebody, whether it be a friend, a family member, or a professional. But for the rest of us, I just want to share with you, I guess, real quick how this way of thinking has kind of helped me, and hopefully it can help you, and then I'll be around to answer questions or whatever. So first of all, parenting. I have, like I said, 4 kids. We've all been quarantined for a long time together. My wife and I homeschool, so we're just around each other a lot. My kids are awesome. They're all under 8, and it's great and hard. It's really hard sometimes, but it's helped. It's helped with our patience. It's helped with our understanding, our overall quality of life, I think, that we understand that our kids are behaving in a way that our environment is helping produce. It doesn't necessarily make tough situations go away. It doesn't make things easier. It doesn't make things, it make me like less susceptible to anger, I guess. But it helps to talk about their motivations. It helps to talk about the antecedents and consequences in their lives. What's going on? When one of my kids are being whiny, for example, it's less helpful to get mad at them or coerce them to stop, and it's more helpful to ask myself, how long has it been since I've really given them quality attention that they like? Am I giving more attention to their quote-unquote bad behavior than their good behavior? Am I accidentally rewarding them for something that I don't want to? Am I just shoving a screen in front of their face whenever they act out instead of teaching them how to ask for these things? We've made a habit of like calling them out for the good things they do and trying to do that at least 4 or 5 times more than calling them out for the things we don't want them to do. I want my kids to get big reactions for the things they do, even if they seem mundane or useless. Or not useless, if they seem mundane or trivial, like not important. I want them to know that it's important to do the things that they're doing, and they're doing them well. I want them growing up knowing exactly what they did well. I want them to know what they worked on and accomplished. And I want them to live in an environment in which they learn, they enjoy learning, and they aren't scared to fail. And just a practical example, like when we homeschool, my wife, she has these tickets available. They're just little like carnival tickets. She's got a prize box. The prize box changes each week. There's Pokemon cards, there's snacks, toys, a bunch of really inexpensive things. And as we go through the day, we give tickets, we give them specific praise for completing their checklist of things that they know that they need to get done, and for the random things that we catch them doing. So, hey buddy, you finished your handwriting and you didn't complain today. Here's one of your tickets. Hey, you held the door for your sister even though I didn't even ask you to. No one asked you to do that. I caught that. Thank you. Here's a ticket. 5 tickets equal a prize. They can't lose that ticket after they earn it. That builds trust. We don't have to yell. We don't really have to coerce or punish. We're not perfect. We do sometimes, but we're working on that, and we don't have to all the time. And they always know what the expectation is, and this creates habits. I caught them washing the dishes the other day. We used to have to reward them for that. Now they just do it. They don't do it very well, but they do it. It's cool. It's awesome. And then another area that this has really helped me practically is just in my productivity. There are things that I'm working towards, just like all of us are working towards, but the consequences for those things that we want to accomplish are like a long way off. So immediate consequences usually are a lot more effective. If we started accomplishing things on like day one and meeting our goals as soon as we began putting in the work, we'd all be millionaires right now, and there wouldn't really be much reason to keep working. Accomplishing goals takes time, it takes stamina. And if we don't contact rewarding consequences along the way while we're trying to get to those ultimate goals, we can burn out really quick. In fact, that's a pretty practical definition of burnout, I think. We can hack this though, whether it's things like weight loss, career goals, stopping a bad habit, forming a new good habit, self-care. If you're like me, I have 4 kids, so self-care really for me is just remembering to put deodorant like under both arms in the morning. It's always really evident which ones I didn't put. But rewarding yourself for accomplishing those small daily goals that are toward and going towards your ultimate goal. So identify your values. Decide what you need to do each day that lines up with those values, and then commit yourself to daily action. And I'll repeat that. If you don't hear anything, just hear that. This is good. Identify your values, decide what you need to do each day that lines up with those values, and then commit to daily action. I make a daily list of the things I need to get done. As I knock those out, I cross them off. It's rewarding to me just to cross them off and to look back through the days and see what I've accomplished. I schedule my day down to even when I take breaks sometimes, because I need that. I get off task very easily. Reward yourself for doing that. I get people to help me do that. I tell them what I want to do. If I did it, they help deliver my reward for me. Make small, attainable, objective goals. If I work on this project for 3 hours today, I'll go out with friends tonight. Quantify, measure. After you accomplish them, move on to the next step. I used to track like how many pages I read each day. I use that as a baseline to know what I wanted to get to. I want to increase by 10% next week. That's nerdy, I know, but I used to do that. And then you reward yourself for meeting those goals. And lastly, just remember that we have the power to do a lot of good, and we have the power to do a lot of harm. I am in the camp of choosing good. Thank you guys so much. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Kyle. You guys, one more round of applause for Kyle Steery today. That was really awesome. Well, now we're going to have a brief Q&A session, and Devontae Beckham is going to run that for us. So I'm going to invite him up to host our Q&A.
Thank you, Kara. Thank you, Kyle. First, I think there are so many aspects of your talk that deserve questions. But we're going to start in the audience and anybody online. If you guys have any questions, I'm standing right here, and I can come bring you the mic. So we can kick it off with a question from absolutely anybody. So let's get it started.
You work with so many vulnerable populations. Can you talk a little bit about how these populations are dealing with COVID and kind of how you're working with people who need to be face-to-face maybe right now during this crazy time?
That is an awesome question, and the answer probably changes each day. But yeah, there's a lot of immunocompromised people that we work with, and it's very difficult. One, it's difficult to explain what's going on. Some might not quite comprehend why they can't leave their homes anymore. Just today, I was talking to somebody who actually had a client who passed away from COVID, and so dealing with, you know, I think we all just changed. Like when this happened, our demeanors changed very quickly. I talked about kind of how our kids pick up on that. Like we don't talk about a whole lot of things coronavirus related in front of our kids, but they know like something's going on. They're very observant. And I think that goes on too. You know, we might not think that the people that, you know, that I'm working with are really like picking up on that, but they definitely are. Like our behavior is changing. I'm a little more apprehensive than I used to be, I think, things like that. I think it's really important to make things available. Like I talked about freedom of choice. We have to limit choices kind of by the nature of quarantine now. So what can they choose now? Like what can we provide people that can't leave their homes all of a sudden? I helped a mom who didn't know how to set up Zoom the other day so that her kid could see his cousins. She's like, oh, I thought this was just a medical thing. Like, no, you can actually do that with people like across the world, really. And all of a sudden, her kid, who was really, really friends with his cousins, could talk to his cousins. And so it's just little things like that. We have to be creative sometimes. Yeah, does that answer your question?
Do we have anybody else? Okay.
What do you think the biggest misconception or myth is about people that have autism?
I think the best person to ask about that is somebody who has autism. They'd be able to enlighten you a lot more than I would. But I think, you know, you hear a lot, especially, you hear about what will work, what will quote unquote cure them, that there is no cure for autism. You hear a lot about making them less autistic, which is, not good. I don't recommend moving conversations in that direction either. You know, that's part of who they are. Working with populations and certain demographics, I before I deserve a chance to really work with you, I deserve an opportunity, or you deserve the opportunity for me to learn about your disability, right? So that's another misconception. There are a lot of misconceptions, but those are probably the biggest ones. I think people thinking that they're just that way, or they're just difficult, and not recognizing that they do have a disability. A lot of microaggressions come in the conversation when that happens too. Yeah, does that answer your question?
Do we have another question?
So just wanted to hear from you, since you've, well, obviously been around, you know, people of all ages, you know, been around that behavior. How do you feel about, you know, the nature versus nurture, you know? I just want to pick your mind about that.
So the question's about nature versus nurture, and the answer is yes to both of those things. I think that, you know, we are living creatures, so you can't ignore the nature side of things. And behavior analysis recognizes that living being interacts with a world around it, you know what I mean? So to deny somebody's, you know, genetics or biological or biology, things like that, would be to disregard a really important part of who they are. But at the same time, you know, I can walk in to one house in America and say one thing, and then walk into another house and say that exact same thing and get two totally different responses from the people around me. So to answer your question, yes, I think both occur, and to overlook one is to ignore the big picture.
All right, that'll be the end of our Q&A. Can we get one more round of applause for Kyle today? Woo! Thank you, Kyle, for sure. And thank you for everybody that came out face-to-face and also everybody online. Thank you so much. If you guys want to make sure to look out for details for our next event, check our Facebook, Instagram. And we're really excited for next month to see what we have in store. So thank you guys so much again.
This has been an episode of WBOI Presents. Special thanks to Kara Hackett, Devontae Beckham, Colin Madden, and the rest of the Creative Warnings team for making this show possible. Thank you to WBOI's Brittany Smith for providing the audio for this program. Additional content from WBOI Presents and our community partners can be found at WBOI.org. Our music is by Mark Waldick, Noah Campadonico, and Kurt Remke. Our web producer is Loyal Vandenberg. Our production assistants are Monica Blankenship, Steve Mullaney, and Sydney Wagner. Until next time, thank you for listening. From WBOI Fort Wayne.